I ought really to apologize to Mr. Chairman, everyone. I've got no thesis to offer, and it's something to do with a sociological or psychological kind of set of remarks which I wish to deliver. I'm not a sociologist or a psychologist. I speak in extreme ignorance, and only want to offer this as a sort of collection of impressions which I formed on a topic which interests me. And that is about the fact that various countries or nations appear to have a kind of collective class consciousness, if you like, which is not unlike that of individuals. We're a very class conscious country, and everyone knows what that means. People in this country on the whole tend to think of themselves as belonging to this or that class, and this modifies their political and their social behavior. One knows what that means by contrast with a country like, say, the United States, which has, of course, deep social divisions, but where one knows that very few people, for example, think of themselves as belonging to the lower classes or the working classes. Whatever they may in fact belong to, they don't think of themselves as that, and therefore any appeal to them, as, for example, members of the working class or as the poor against the rich, falls flat. Because whatever the reality may be, this isn't that image of themselves. And obviously, however images are born in people's breasts, once they are born, they have a very profound effect on people's behavior. Well, what I should like to propound is the view that this is also true of nations as well as individuals. That, for example, all countries have a certain image of themselves. They usually think very well of themselves. Almost all countries think that they are simple, honest, decent, rather puzzled human beings in danger of being misled by a lot of cunning, sophisticated, wicked foreigners. I mean, this is an image which the Americans have of themselves, it's an image which the French have of themselves even, vis-a-vis the English, it's a vision which the English have of themselves vis-a-vis the French, it's the image the Russians in the 19th century had of themselves vis-a-vis Europeans, it's an image with which people start. And this kind of image tends to be, to some extent, modified by the opinion of them which other people held. For example, in the 18th century, the Germans, having been defeated by the French, were much despised and began to despise themselves. In the 19th century, the Russians were much despised for their barbarism and began to have acute fits of enormous national self-pity, and which were, of course, in due course, followed by extreme fits of national exasperated pride, who start by accepting other people's opinion of themselves, and then some people will always try and make out that the thing which other people think ill in you is in fact an enormous virtue in you. I mean, other people think it's bad of you to be barbarous, ill-educated, and savage, then you say, well, at any rate, we're not smooth, polite, sophisticated, stuffy, formalistic. At least we have some kind of passionate and spontaneous attitude to the world, which our detractors have not. And so, the image of people in themselves is to some extent formed partly by what they think themselves, partly by a kind of reflected version of what other people think of them. These images tend to change with extreme abruptness. If we think, for example, of, say, the French and the Germans, as they were thought of, say, in about 1850, let's say, as a year, perhaps 1845 would be better, and again, say, in 1875. If we take the earlier date, the French, well, say, 1855, the French were thought of as a very gallant, swashbuckling nation of soldiers with enormous twirling mustachios, gallant with ladies, very immoral, full of imagination, with civilized values, dashing, dangerous, and on top of the world. Whereas the Germans are thought of as a pedantic, rather boring nation, comical, full of professors who occupied all kinds of unimportant and pedantic and tedious subjects, laughing stocks on the whole, and no danger to anybody. Then if you look exactly at the picture in 1880, you get the Germans suddenly, the kind of marching army of Prussians, extremely rigid, extremely well-disciplined, very terrifying, whereas the French have become a collection of very defenseless, rather neurotic persons, full of repositories of an ancient and important culture, and must on all accounts be protected against barbarous onslaughts from without. The same thing happens to other people. I mean, it's happened to all kinds of other nations. It's happened to the Russians, for example, who, from having had a sort of mystical Slav soul in the late 19th century, have suddenly turned into a kind of Martians, almost, in some people's imaginations now. Very, very quickly, too. This has happened to the Turks. If you think about the Turks, like in 1910, what the Turks are thought of now, you'll find the image is totally different. Well, this business about how nations think of themselves, how others think of them, also has a certain relevance to how they react to others, obviously. And if they find themselves on the inferior portion of this apparently widely accepted social scale of precedence, I don't know what else to call it, they tend to react accordingly. I remember very well when I was in America in 1940, I had dealings with various groups of immigrants. And I talked to an immigrant, I think an Italian immigrant, about somebody else who was in fact a Swede. And he was talking about immigrants, and I said something about my Swedish friend, and he seemed to look up to him rather, and I said, isn't he an immigrant too? And he said, ah, yes, he is an immigrant, but he comes from one of those classy countries. And I suddenly realized there was a deep image, in my Italian's mind, certainly, between classy and non-classy countries in which you might come. And there was a terrific difference of status, even though you might be a poor immigrant, in both cases. Classy countries, roughly, were, I suppose, the British Isles, not Ireland, Northern Ireland perhaps, Southern Ireland certainly not, Scandinavia, Holland, Germany. Everything else was non-classy, at least less classy, in graduated stages. Certainly Central Europe was not classy, certainly Italy was not, and once you got to countries east and south of that, they became totally classless. So it's really no class at all. And this is the kind of thing, I mean, this is of course how the Americans and indeed the Canadians do organize their quota system to some extent. A little bit in accordance with this. And I have a feeling that this is a thing which is very deep in people's imagination and affects them at least as much as, for example, economic considerations or political ambitions or other factors which are regarded as frightfully important in determining national conduct. And that, for example, the Bandung Conference of the Afro-Asian nations is to some extent created by the common sense of, I suppose one ought to call it, social inferiority versus the West, which isn't entirely to do with just imperialism or being, so to speak, done in at some earlier stage of our life. It's something to do with our general social status. So that even Americans who imagine that when they come and explain that they've never been imperialistic, they've never oppressed these nations, that they don't come to exploit, they merely come to help, which they say with the greatest possible sincerity and goodwill, find to their own surprise they're treated exactly as if they had been these wicked imperialistic Englishmen, because it's not a matter of careful memories of past history or of expediency, it's a matter of their accent, their looks, the kind of looks on their faces, the colour of their hair, the colour of their eyes, the way they get up and sit down. It's some sort of complex of qualities towards which these people react, exactly as class-conscious persons react to other class-conscious persons in their own society. And this curious fact that there should be this class-consciousness among nations seems to be important, because obviously what nations want is equality of status. And I think this desire for equality of status, which is the same, I suppose, as nationalism at some stage, which can, of course, take very aggressive and ugly forms, it seems to be a very, very deep thing in them, and isn't cured by a lot of persons coming to them with, for example, offers of help or offers of aid. Because if it's awful to be bullied, if it's awful to be treated as Indians, say, were treated in sort of in Ian Foster's Passage to India, in this sort of obviously cold-hearted and snubbing way in which the Englishmen of that novel, or the majority of them, treat the Indians, if it's awful, it's also awful to have people who say, we've come to help you, in a kind of Boy Scout spirit. Of extreme benevolent patronage, in which people come in because you must be very, very pathetic, very, very degraded, or hardly conscious of your status at all, if that helps you. In the end, you may accept the help, but you dislike the helper. And therefore, it seems to me that there is a Scylla and the Charybdis. There is a Scylla of not bullying people and not sitting on them and not governing them or not being nasty to them. But there is also a Charybdis of not being over nice to them, not coming to them with an open heart and seeking somehow to be a sort of missionary among them. I think the old missionaries were all right, because they didn't think about themselves at all. They thought about there was a certain truth which they wanted to inculcate, and they had no sense of inferiority or superiority to the people they were preaching to. But when people with economic help or political help or all kinds of benevolent persons from the West come among, let us say, Arabs or the Negroes of Africa, whatever it may be, there is a kind of natural desire to, there is a kind of attitude on their part of wishing to bring them up to their own status in some way. No doubt for these people's good, and this ultimately produces resentment. It ultimately produces possibly at first gratitude, but later extremely wounded feelings. And therefore it seems to me that this is a factor which perhaps hasn't been sufficiently noticed in the dealings between clinicians. Eric Jones.
But aren't we dealing here with simply the tendency of any group of people to encourage their own loyalty by forming an image both of their enemies and of themselves? I mean, nationalism is, as Zaire says, of course, moderately recent. But before that, you've had regional affiliations, even villages. The men from the next village are like this. You get it in England today, of course. The northerner has this picture of the effete southerner, and the southerner has the picture of the northerner more or less covered with hair, and so on, you see. And any community, it seems to be, it merely is, surely, that the nation, for certain purposes, is the unit, and it naturally forms this image of itself or of its opponents. I mean, where do we go from here, as it were? That's really what I...
What's also quite interesting, I think, is that this image is not only formed by people of themselves, in terms of their own allegiance, but to some extent under the influence of the opinion of them held by others. This happens on a national scale.
Oh, I think that's quite true. It's certainly true of Northerners.
Well, it's true of the Russians in the 19th century, who spent their time in writing novels about the appalling condition they were in, and apologizing to the West, or else being aggressively non-apologetic.
It's not a phenomenon of nationalism, is it, at all? It's a phenomenon of any group of human beings. I don't know what makes that kind of
group is. Just one thing, I don't think this evening it's necessary to go anywhere.
Oh, I
you asked where we're going. You don't want to go.
Not good.
That was a question not expecting an answer.
No, actually. Eric has appealed to me.
Isn't it that, Scotland?
Isn't it that problems of relations between groups are always very complex, and in order to handle them, groups tend to simplify them. And they simplify them by forming a stereotype of the other group to which they react. But I think I'd like to complicate the problem by suggesting that they form a series of stereotypes, some of which contradict one another, so that while we may think of the French as effete, neurotic, and civilized, I don't know why Sir Isaiah thinks that civilized must necessarily imply being effete and neurotic at the same time.
I don't. Just defect of hope.
We may also at the same time think of them as gallant, brave, courageous soldiers, and the stereotype that comes to play at any one moment depends upon the reality of their actual relations with them at any one moment. So the picture which was held of the Russians, say, during the last 20 years could change rapidly according with the actually existing realities of our present political relations with them. Similarly, our picture of the Americans might change from moment to moment. We might at one moment regard them as powerful, skilled people coming to our aid, and the next moment as bombastic people who were boastful of their triumphs, which we had won in Burma, judging by their films, and so on. So I think there are a whole series of stereotypes which simplify the reaction in any specific political situation, and those that come into play at any one moment are determined by the realities of the political situation, which are realities with which the nation has to deal. Now, we can't handle political situations if we think of the other group with which we're involved in terms of all the complexities of differentiated personal relations, and we oversimplify every situation except for a few of us. And those few of us are not good citizens, because we realize that not all Germans are bad, not all Americans are bad, not all Russians are bad. There may be something to be said for Russia. There may be something to be said for America. There may even be something to be said for South Africans.
I wonder if I could just ask Max Gluckman a question. He said they come into play. I mean, is this a sort of spontaneous activity, self-generated, or what did he mean, these selective stereotypes?
I think the situation itself, if we move into a new relationship with a particular country, as we have with Germany, it produces the picture of the angels of Munich, which we in Manchester are so conscious of at the moment, and the picture of our relations with the Germans, which existed for 9 years, may go out of play. Well, if we were to go to war with Germany again, the angels of Munich might be very quickly forgotten.
Dennis Chapman, does that satisfy you, isn't it?
Well, I just wondered whether or not things like the Ministry of Information that I once worked for, or the Foreign Office handouts, or something in the establishment didn't in fact play a part in, for example, changing our image of the gallant, heroic defender of Stalingrad?
Very little. You remember Francis Cornford's definition of propaganda as the as that branch of the art of lying, which consists in not deceiving your enemies and quite deceiving your friends.
I'm not so sure about this. You see, one goes back to the few years before 1914, when all the hate complex was being developed about Germany, and we were given a picture of Germany which would justify the fact that ultimately we were obviously going to war with her. Now, I think it was one of the owners of the popular press who said, "The people like a good hate, and we're going to give them one." And they gave them one in the form of Germany. And it seems to me that Dennis Chapman is onto something here when he implies that the stereotype that we see of other nations is to a large extent artificial and may be induced by those who, for various reasons of their own, want us to see the other nations in the form of this stereotype. And equally, it seems to me that we're asked to see ourselves in the form of a particular stereotype when it suits all the organs of publicity and propaganda to do so. On this point, for instance, I'd very much like to hear Sir Isaiah on this popular conception that we ought to be thinking in terms of a new Elizabethan age, you see, as though there's something in common between Elizabethan England as it was 300 years ago and what we are today. I mean, who produces this stereotype? Why do we accept it?
Do you have any views about the new Elizabethan age?
I've got no views about the new Elizabethan age.
God, but just in connection with that, I don't think these induced sentiments are necessarily produced for sinister reasons or for pure reasons of, say, political expediency. Sometimes they are. But you see, for example, the American image of China is quite an interesting case in point. And this is largely produced by Chinese missionaries, who are good people, fond of the Chinese, who certainly bred in the Americans, certainly when I first went there in 1940-41, a sort of picture of a nation entirely touched with grace. Almost a community of saints. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the disappointment when they went communist was the most violent upheaval in American consciousness. Mm-hmm. Don't you think it was induced by anybody for any particular reason?
Well, surely the stereotype that the American has of the communist government in China now has some connection with the China lobby.
Some connection, certainly, but I think the China lobby would have had nothing to build on. And there hadn't been an appalling sense of letdown from the Americans, which was a natural development.
Yeah. Great sense of disappointment. The Chinese, who had always been their allies, were now their enemies.
Oh, wonderful people, and unrequited love is the most horrid of sentiments.
Peter Hilton.
Well, Mr. Chairman, your remark to Sir Eric James when he put his rhetorical question, "Where do we go from here?" shows that you, like I, are lulled into this cosy Oxford Senior Common Room atmosphere which Sir Isaiah Berlin has so beautifully engendered for us. We are calmly and with all the time in the world, knowing the future is on our side, discussing this question. And I want to play an uncharacteristic role of throwing a few spanners in the works. At least I want my remarks to have the function and the quality that if they're not true, they will be false, and that I won't be simply sort of reminiscing about my experiences of some nation or another. I won't be tempted to describe what I discovered in Switzerland, for example, about what the Swiss think of themselves.
Why not? You have expectations.
Well, you know the answer, don't you, Dennis? I want to say, first of all, that I disagree hotly with Sir Isaiah when he says that nations want equality of status. It seems to me to be absolute nonsense. Surely it's only the nations that regard themselves as inferior who want equality of status. And they only want this as a stepping stone to superiority. And isn't it a fact about the relationships between nations today that they're all seeking superiority to each other, and this is an extremely unstable situation? I also want to ask three questions, which I suppose you could regard as rhetorical, but I hope you won't. First of all, is it not perhaps the case that what one nation thinks of another is very largely a product of that other nation's economic prosperity? If you take Sir Isaiah's example of the Italian and the Swede, isn't it probably to some extent due to the fact of Swedish prosperity that the Italian takes this view? And as to what a nation thinks of itself, to how great an extent is this conditioned, firstly, by a conviction that the nation has a monopoly of culture, and secondly, by the conviction that the members of that nation are able, rather effectively, to control their sexual appetites. Because it has appeared to me, in my own unprofessional study of this question, that the attitude which we take towards Italians and Spanish and the Mediterranean peoples is very largely due to the fact that we don't show our emotions very much, and we like to think we don't have the sort of fierce emotions which these rather primitive people do have. So I would rather like to have Sir Isaiah and other members' views on this question of whether the factors which I brought forward are considerable or not.
Well, that was a jolly good effort at being red, Rick. Thank you very much.
I come from the same university as Sir Isaiah.
Oh, we know that. I don't believe that all nations who seek equality seek superiority. Some do, some don't. I think you go perhaps a little too far. I don't know that the poor Latvians, the poor Estonians, when they became independent states, sought superiority to anybody terribly.
But if I may just intervene, if all want equality and some want superiority, mustn't this be an unstable situation?
Ah, but I wouldn't be denying that our situation is unstable whatever happens. I'm not at all suggesting that the search for equality leads to stable situations, or even that it's possible. I was only wanting to state this, because this is in fact what people want very, very badly indeed. And to give them quite different things, such as economic prosperity or other blessings, won't satisfy them. And this is a kind of root, that's what I really wanted to say. Yeah. Not that it's things which are likely to make for peace necessarily. Then I quite agree with you, I think, about the last point about the fact that repressed and continent nations despise unrepressed and incontinent ones. But this is returned with enormous gusto. If you think about the views of English on the part of, let us say, the more sort of Frenchmen who are allowed to a greater degree of self-expression, the contempt for the sort of cold, boring, and inward-looking Englishmen is at least as great as our extreme shock at these violent public exhibitions on the part of ill-educated persons themselves.
And much better expressed.
And a good deal more articulate, yes.
Well, Lord.
I think, Mr. Chairman, it's fascinating to try to find out just what are the sort of pressures that produce these stereotypes, and stereotypes not only between one country and another, but within a society, the way in which we have them as far as social and class distinctions are concerned, and as regards religion as well. I can remember a schoolmistress not very long ago who always divided the entire population of British Isles into whether they were Bushy or Vere de Vere. And I heard the other day of a staunch Ulster Protestant who was told by his doctor that he had only 6 months to live, and 3 months afterwards he suddenly joined the Roman Catholic Church. And when his friends protested and asked him why he'd done it, well, he said, I think it's a lot better that one of them should die than one of us. I think that if you carry this a little further and you turn to source books like, for example, the Sapper books, Drummond and the Sapper books, and John Buchan runs him a pretty close second, you find a wonderfully rich mine of stereotypes. I'm just waiting for some Freudian here to jump into the fray.
Max Newman.
I can't understand why in discussions of this kind one must assume that there really are no differences between peoples. All this talk we hear about stereotypes, I suggest that one of the simple explanations of why people think that nations are different is that they are different. I was only a few weeks ago since I heard people talking at the lunch table in the university, and they were saying, how do you think this idea arises that Manchester is wet? Is it really necessary that we should go on talking about these stereotypes as if there were no differences between nations? When it comes to races, the word race has not been mentioned, only nations, but I suppose we are talking about differences between races. And if people have different coloured skins, why shouldn't they behave in different ways and have different capabilities? suggests this with great trepidation, that Sir Isaiah even seemed to suggest that these differences were, they were matters of fashion, they changed, they came and went, and that really there was very little difference. Perhaps he was.
Will you drive, please? Yes, I'm ready to. Whether I agreed with the greater part of these very unpopular and provocative remarks, with which I think I'm in agreement. I think, you see, I don't see why, I think I wanted to agree with Mr. Brookman to the effect that stereotypes are not avoidable. We can't, in fact, think about foreign nations in all the rich variety of all the characteristics which we may have observed. Consequently, we are bound to some extent to think of them in fairly stylized ways. That, I think, is unavoidable. But I don't see why it should be assumed that these stereotypes are necessarily always falsifying and libelous. They are sometimes highly complimentary, and sometimes the more we learn, the more the stereotype gets wedged in us, both hostile and friendly.
They may or may not.
They may or may not. Exactly. But I don't know why many. The assumption, I think, was a little bit that stereotypes are things to be avoided. And what we must do is to study all these types, so to speak, in their full, rich, concrete variety. Well, that's a very desirable ideal, but that obviously can't be achieved. And therefore, all we can do, I think, is to see to that our stereotypes correspond at least roughly. But I entirely agree with the last speaker to the effect that there are differences, that it's something a little, I think, suspicious about us, that we don't want to face the fact that there are different aptitudes connected with different races or different nations, and that perhaps if this was faced a little more resolutely, we should be nearer the truth. And the notion that everybody is frightfully similar, and all differences are superficial, is something to do with the desire to escape from some set of disagreeable facts or other. I don't quite know what. Something like that. I don't see why it shouldn't be the case we're all very different and very nice too.
Now, we've got a quadrilateral here, all wanting to come in. Cordelia James, you seem to be the most urgent, and you're also a lady, so come in first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I should have thought the whole jam that we're in at the moment is just because we have accepted the Western white stereotype for about the last 2,000 years, based partly on, of course, the traditions of Christianity, partly on the traditions of Greece and Rome. And we've accepted that. It's been exemplified in Greece and Rome, then in England, and now perhaps in the United States. And I think that another cycle is possibly now beginning. I'd like to ask Sir Isaiah who the top people are now. Are they the United States or are they the Russians?
The pillars of all souls. Bishop Greer.
That's a stereotype too.
As we draw towards a conclusion, as I suppose we must, I should like to feel that we've got some little practical conclusion as a result of our discussion. And one seemed to peep out at the end of Sir Isaiah's opening remarks, and that was on this question of how, assuming that there are these pictures in people's minds, how can we do anything to solve that modern problem, which is an immense problem, touched upon by Mr. Kennan in his famous Reef lecture. How can you help another nation in such a way that you will not either trample upon them or pauperize them and antagonize them? You mentioned, Sir Isaiah, that that didn't happen in the missionary enterprise. That was true, I think, in the earlier days. Today, it's a very real problem in the missionary enterprise throughout the world in Christian churches. And I would very much value your remarks on what the answer is there. What can be done? Is there any practical thing that can be done to ease this problem, such as, for instance, canalizing all assistance and aid, not direct but through the United Nations or in some other way? Because it's one of the main problems we're facing today, it seems, in the world.
Would you like to answer? I have no concrete suggestions to make. I'm not very competent. But I should have thought this is the kind of problem which has to be solved in practice. There's no general rule can be given. One has to do exactly what one does in the case of helping individuals, I think. How do people manage to help individuals without antagonizing them? By the use of what kind of tact? By knowing what not to say? By, in some sort of way, by exercising judgment, by having some kind of insight into the kind of people they are, and if they're benevolent fools, they do, of course, blunder and do create most terrible problems with the best possible motives in the world, and that, I think, has happened, particularly in the case, I think, of American, but to some extent in the case of our aid too. If you say, what are we to do with people who need aid, but who perhaps resent patronage? Well, I think each case has to be treated on its merits. We have to weigh their needs. We ought to seek to do what they want rather than what we think is good for them, but sometimes what they want is, we think, really bad for us. In which case, I don't think they're obliged to do everything and martyrize ourselves in the process, but of course we must balance different claims, our own utility, their needs, other people's opinions of them, their opinion of us. How can this be done except by choosing the, I don't know, nicest, best, wisest?
John,
I think we ought to clear up this confusion between differences between stereotypes, which is a purely subjective conception, and so-called real differences. Previous speaker, I think, identified these two, which are quite different things. I won't say anything more about that. The danger of overlooking the subjective stereotype, which Sir Isaiah spoke about, was illustrated a little while ago when the Schuman plan was being discussed, when the German newspapers represented Michel, the German character, national character, as marrying Marianne. That symbolized their acceptance of the Schuman plan. But the French regarded this as a suggestion of adultery on the part. Of Marianne, and an imputation of lack of virility on the part of the French. Quite apart from the nations have problems. On the basis of which they behave and treat other peoples. There are other national characteristics which can be demonstrated, in fact are much more demonstrable than so-called racial or ethnic characters, which are in fact environmentally determined. Mm-hmm. And these national characteristics in behavior can also be politically important. For example, when the Americans were dissatisfied with the Korean decision. It seemed to be because they never like vague outcomes. They like everything to be clear-cut, and this can be shown in every walk of American life, not only in the military situation. But that, again, is a long story, and you have to show how this develops in upbringing through different stages. I mean, there's one stage in the child's life, for example, when the English child, for example, thinks the Frenchman is a foreigner, even when he's in Paris. And that an Englishman is never a foreigner, wherever he is. The American wouldn't come in at the customs barriers at Dover, where it said foreigners. He said, I'm not a foreigner, I am an American. And the other point I'd like to make in reference to the speaker's last remarks and the bishop's question is that we can help others by asking them to help us. We seem to have a conviction that we can only teach, we've got nothing to learn. If we went to these people and asked them to help and advise us, what can we learn from you? But we seem to think, and I think the Americans in particular, if you haven't got any dollars, you haven't any ideas, you haven't got anything. And we also seem to share this delusion, dangerous delusion, that we've only got things to give, nothing to receive, nothing to learn.
Thank you. Lewis Wright.
Yes, sir. I've come across some quite extraordinary reactions to these sort of things in other countries recently. A fortnight ago, I was in Greece, and speaking to a working-class organization and discussing Cyprus, they said to me, well, of course, we know the TUC attitude to this matter and the Labour Party's attitude towards it, but what are the British going to do? giving me the impression, at least, that they subdivided, and that the Greek workers, at least, think of the British as the exploiters from history, as the imperialists conquering half the world, and so on. And they think of the working class people as being something completely different. They don't stereotype working class people. And the stereotypes of history and the stereotypes in all lands are not working class people at all. And the stereotype of the Greek people, for instance, has been acquired over the last 100 years by the visitors to the Acropolis, to Agra, and so on. Now, I think this is acquired through history on the one hand, ignorance on the other, and not being able to visit each other. And I've discovered, without doubt at all, that if people can meet each other more often, if there can be greater travel, if workers particularly and others can meet each other abroad in each other's country, then within the next 10 years, these stereotypes, which are so marked in all countries of the world, will very, very soon disappear. And I would say to Dr. Greer that one way to help to eradicate these stereotypes is greater travel, greater meetings of peoples of the world. This, more than anything else, in my judgment, will help to eradicate these false impressions of the stereotypes that we hear so much about.
Thank you, Lucia. Alistair McIntyre.
I quite agree with Professor Newman that there are real differences between nations, only you've got to be careful that you really know what they are. I belong to a people that 200 years ago were regarded by the English much as the Bantu are regarded by African or South Africans today.
And very rightly.
We've come on wonderfully in the last 200 years. One of the differences, and the big ones...
What nation are you referring to?
The Gaelic Scot. One of the differences between peoples is the differences to their relationship, differences in their relationship to their stereotype. The fact, at two extremes, that you can be related to the stereotype in a harmful way. On the one hand, in these islands, you've got the English, who are so closely identified with their stereotype that they don't usually realize they have one in a serious way. It's only when you hear the English talking about what the British say and what the British believe, when they mean, in the south of England, they mean what they say and believe in Surrey. In the north, they mean anything south of Berwick-on-Tweed. But the confines of the English within their picture of themselves, their complete unself-consciousness of it, the way in which they go around telling people how glad they are they don't belong to a nationalistic culture. This is one extreme, and the other extreme, the Irish, who have a picture of the nation which is completely detached from reality altogether, something that some of the best younger people in Ireland have identified themselves with from time to time in the IRA, and that leads into frustration and murder and complete uselessness. Now, I would like to just suggest, mainly for Sir Isaiah's criticism, that the best relationship a nation can have to its stereotype is one which is not too serious, in which it's got an image of itself so that it's able to think about itself in a fairly simple way, but one in which at the same time the image isn't really a burden you carry or something that you have to worry about, but something that's of real use to you. I'm not sure that I can think of a nation which has ever managed to stand in this ideal relationship, but it seems to be something that people approximate to more or less.
Thank you. Sidney Rabel.
I just wanted to say a word, Mr. Chairman, about the, I think, very important question that the Bishop of Manchester raised and that John Cohen commented on. During a stay in West Africa, both in Ghana and in Nigeria some years ago, I was very much struck by the importance of this point. And it seemed to me that if the initiative is left with them in asking for help, and if help is given on the sort of terms which they suggest, there is a chance of help being given without the consequences in the shape of resentment. I found that both in Ghana and in Nigeria, they wanted to feel that they could look anywhere they pleased for help, that they weren't always going to have to ask Britain for help, that they could ask Germans and Americans and even Russians for help. We know there are political difficulties, but we're talking about the psychological aspect of that.
Lindsay Platt.
You'll be relieved to hear, Mr. Chairman, that I'm not going to use the word stereotype. I want to go back to what Sir Isaiah said at the beginning. I'm still puzzled. I don't know what problem he has posed, and if he retorts it wasn't a problem, it's a subject, then I don't really understand the subject. What he said at the beginning seemed to me to be full of errors. He started by contrasting national consciousness with class consciousness. He said an appeal falls flat if directed to a class. For example, the working class.
I can only say that if he really thinks that, he's never lived amongst the working class. And if any government or group today had the nerve to appeal to what used to be called the upper classes, and Sir Isaiah thinks it wouldn't resound silently in their hearts, then I wonder about the class structure of all souls. But let me go back to one example that he mentioned. The French and the Germans in 1845-1875. The French, at the earlier date, swashbuckling, mustachio twirling, and so forth. The Germans, a collection of ineffectual and laughable professors. And the roles reversed after the Franco-Prussian War. The Germans militant, the French neurotic. That is a perfectly true picture. Nations change. National characteristics change. And when people look at nations and say, this nation strikes me as being so-and-so, people are usually right. A man doesn't change his character in the course of his life, he only has one life. Nations have many lives, many generations. A son differs from his father, grandson from the grandfather, and these changes take place in the course of a generation. And you can see that from the attitude we now have, quite rightly, to the French and the Germans since the war, the attitude we had towards them before the war. I don't see where the mystery is.
Well, I think this is where we ask Sir Isaiah to come back again for as short or as long a time as he likes, and say whatever comes into his head, whether in reply to you or not.
Could I ask,
we must get to an end sometime, and I'm afraid we've got to do it
30
now.
30 seconds, either here or there.
Will you obey the chair?
I'll be very brief. I can see that there's very little time. I'll try and reply to my critics as quickly as I can. First, Mr. McIntosh wanted to know about what kind of relation we ought to have to our stereotypes, to use that fatal word again. I agree with him. I think there is something dangerous about people who die for their stereotype, as the Irish or Ept or the Poles used to be, where there is a burning image of some sort which corresponds to something in their hearts, but certainly isn't a description of their habits in any way, and to which people become martyrs in the most violent romantic spirit, which earns a great deal of praise, leads to a great deal of art and poetry, and breeds an enormous amount of suffering and misery in the process. And if he says, well, what nation is, on the right sort of terms with its own image, I don't know. I suppose the smaller Scandinavian nations, I have to say, rather tamely. I think the Danes are in a very easy, comfortable relation to that stereotype. Very few Danes feel an impulse to do superhuman acts in the name of the ideal image of Denmark. Nobody, non-messianic images, I think, is what's on the whole desirable. And I should have thought that these nations are rightly regarded as civilized, partly in direct proportion to the extent to which there isn't a sort of lunatic romanticism which impels them forward, however splendid the artistic results. In answer to Mr. Platt, I think the nations don't change with quite the rapidity which he assumes. He wants to know what problem I'm posing. The problem I'm posing is this. I think there are differences, and I think we think of people in different terms, perhaps sometimes rightly, sometimes wrongly. But I think that when we produce form orders in our heads, as we do, and when we give different nations different types of status in our minds, this tends to influence these nations' images of themselves. And quite apart from the other factors which make them unhappy, this itself creates a climate of public opinion which makes them unhappy too. I mean, as I say, the Russians in the 19th century, for example, made themselves miserable without very much necessity in certain respects, because they felt too much contempt was being poured upon them in the West. Too much contempt, which is in fact undeserved, but nevertheless, they accepted other people's judgment of them. And this whole problem of the dependence of human beings upon the judgments of them, often expressed by people wholly ignorant of them, is something which is very difficult to cure. I'm not even sure whether foreign travel, a greater degree of knowledge will cure it. But sometimes the better we know people, the more we like them. Sometimes the better we know people, the more we dislike them. I think it cuts both ways. I think it doesn't do it entirely smuggled, that's all. As for the question of class consciousness, I do think there is a vast difference between political parties in Europe, which certainly appeal to economic classes, and political parties in, say, America, which don't appeal to classes as such, the main factory classes, but it's a very powerful factor in American society that they won't recognize this fact, and this itself plays a part in American politics, and a very significant part. Again, whether it's a good thing to be deceived in this way, or a bad thing, I'm not going to pronounce about. But I think it is a very profound chasm, it is a great chasm, between those who feel it and those who don't. In conclusion, there's really, if I'm asked what thesis I want to produce, or whether there's some particular proposition which I want to defend, I don't really think there is. I think it is simply that there is a great desire for equality, there is inequality is partly the result of people's opinion, and
some of the world's ills come from partly accurate and partly inaccurate images of other people, which I don't think can in fact be eliminated, and which in fact I think is simply a neglected factor in international relations. That's all I really wanted to say. I didn't really want either to condemn it, to praise it, or to say anything else about it, except to constate it.
When we were about a quarter way through this discussion, we came to the conclusion we probably didn't want to go anywhere much. I have a curious feeling that although we weren't deliberately trying to go anywhere, we may perhaps have arrived somewhere. And for wherever we've arrived, I would like to thank you, Sir Isaiah, as also to thank you for listening to us.
I'm delighted to listen to you, far more to listen to myself.
Well, it goes both ways. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Sir Isaiah Berlin addressing the 51 Society on the subject of national superiority and inferiority. Neil Pearson was in the chair, and the other members and guests who took part in the discussion were Sir Eric James, Professor H.M. Gluckman, Dennis Chapman, Victor Wiseman, Peter Hilton, Ronald Lloyd, Professor M.H.A. Newman, Lady James, the Bishop of Manchester, Professor J. Cohen, Lewis Wright, Alistair McIntyre, Professor S.G. Raybould, and Lindsay Platt. This was a recorded and shortened version of the original proceedings.